Anyway, last time we finished Acts chapter 1, and as you know, we're going through the book of Acts, and we're letting the text define the subjects along the way. So today we'll begin in Acts 2, and I know Pentecost was not all that long ago, and this may be somewhat of a review, but also there may be some things that we didn't cover back then that we'll cover today. So let's begin in Acts chapter 2. Verse 1, when the day of Pentecost arrived, they were all together in one place. Now let's stop right there before we continue to verse 2. I don't know how far we're going to get into this chapter today. Probably not all the way through it, but talk about the day of Pentecost. I think all the people here are familiar with it. They know what the Pentecost is. Some of you here may not know about the history of the controversy surrounding this day. How many of you were in the Worldwide Church of God or the Radio Church of God back when Pentecost was observed on a Monday? And the idea, when you're reading the text back there, we'll go back. Let's go back to Leviticus 23. We'll take a look at that. But when you read that text, just a normal reading, you don't get that. It says you count from the morrow after the Sabbath, the day after the Sabbath, unto the day after the seventh Sabbath. And that day after the seventh Sabbath is the day of Pentecost. I think, how do you get Monday out of that? 49 days plus the 150, Pentecost means 50th, this is the 50th day. Well, what they did was, they said, it says count from the day after the Sabbath. One day from Sunday is Monday, so that was the first day of the count. Monday till, they finally ended up with a Monday. 50th day was a Monday. And for, I guess, a good many years, that's the way they observed it. I came in about the time they were changing it. When finally, a lot of papers, or some papers, had been presented on it. People had objected to that method for a long time. But some people privately observed the Sunday Pentecost, and they went ahead and went to church on Monday, not so they wouldn't be rocking the boat or anything like that, hoping sometime eventually it'd change. It did. It did. But let's read what it says back there in Leviticus 23. Also, I might mention there's another controversy surrounding this day, and that is based on the fact that Rabbinic Judaism observes a fixed calendar date, the date Sivan 6. And you have some people in some of the Church of God groups who observe a Sivan 6, or a fixed calendar date Pentecost. They count from the day after the first high day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It always comes out on a fixed calendar date then. It's not a matter of counting off weeks. And they say, the weeks here that you count, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. That means 7 weeks or 7 groups of 7 days. I say that a week is a group of 7 days always ending with the Sabbath, but they take a different approach. Based on the practice of Judaism, and assuming that that's the way it was done in the time of Jesus. However, there's a lot of information out there. Actually, that was a long time ago, and what was going on during the time the temple was standing? There's a lot of cloudy things there, cloudy issues when you look at the historical data. But evidently it is true, or at least there is evidence to the effect, that the Sadducees actually observed a Sunday Pentecost just as we do. Also, the Samaritans, it's my understanding, and I think to this very day, they still observe a Sunday Pentecost. They have a different calendar they go by, but they have they understand the count tomorrow after the Sabbath the same way we do. And, of course, the Karaites, they understand it that way. I wrote a booklet several years back on this subject, and I put forth the idea there that probably the way we count it was known far more widely than just among the Sadducees and a few other of the Jewish sectarians. Some of the Pharisees probably understood it that way as well. But what apparently happened was that over time, the Pharisees, they were the experts on the law. They were the lawyers. They were the ones who focused on attaching all kinds of rules and regulations, and this happened over a period of time, to the law so as to keep controls around it, to keep people within those boundaries. Of course, they wound up turning the law into some kind of burden, really. The law wasn't a burden, but their interpretation of it became burdensome. And also, they moved away from dwelt mostly in the cities. They were not farmers any longer. And so they began to look at Pentecost as a memorial of the giving of the law rather than as a harvest festival. And so when they began to focus on that, and it may be that the law was given on the day of Pentecost. I can't prove that, but it's a logical theory. It fits what data we have. Nevertheless, that's what they focused on. So then they moved, of course, more. They were more inclined to the fixed calendar date concept because a fixed calendar date makes sense when it's a memorial. You know. So anyway, that's the world we come to by the time of Jesus. And this is the controversy surrounding this day. But let's just look at it briefly back in Leviticus 23. We see it very clearly is a harvest festival. And that's significant to us because we understand there's a spiritual harvest going on. And we see the symbolism here and how that applies to us. We want to look at Leviticus 23 beginning in verse 9. It says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, When you come into the land that I give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest." And he's talking about the barley harvest, the early grain harvest, a certain stage of ripeness. That's what Abib means, the name given to the first month. When that barley was in a certain stage of ripeness, then it was time to bring the wave sheaf to the priest. "And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord so that you may be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it." Now, the question is, which Sabbath is he talking about? Because in chapter 23, which is where he outlines all the feasts of the Lord, he has thus far mentioned three Sabbaths. The first one is mentioned in verse 3, says, 6 days you shall work be done, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest. So this is the weekly Sabbath. It is one of the feasts of the Lord. The weekly Sabbath, top of the list. It occurs every seventh day, not annually. And then he goes into the Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread, and he mentions, and I won't read the whole section, but from verses 4 through 8, he talks about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The first day, no work is to be done, no ordinary work. It's a holy convocation. The word Sabbath is not used, but it's an annual Sabbath. And then on the last day, it's another Sabbath, an annual Sabbath. The word Sabbath is not used, but it says no ordinary work was to be done. So you have three Sabbaths mentioned here. How do you know which one when it says, in the verse we just read a few minutes ago, it says, on the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it, down in the latter part of verse 11. How do you know which Sabbath it was? Pharisees, the rabbinic Jews, say it's the high day Sabbath, the first high day Sabbath, Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Sadducees and us, I guess we're Sadducean, but us, we believe that this is talking about the weekly Sabbath, so that it would be the first day after the Sabbath that occurs within the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And actually, the Essenes, from the evidence that I've looked at, the Essenes, apparently, with their own solar-based calendar, they didn't use the same calendar, evidently, that the Jews in Judea used, but with their solar-based calendar, they'd come up with a system whereby they looked at the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread and counted from there, on the day after the last day was the first day of the count. So, which is it? Which is it? Well, I think we have some clues here. First of all, as I've already mentioned, the only one thus far that's called Sabbath is the weekly Sabbath. So it would make sense at this point, it says on the day after the Sabbath, this would be referring to the weekly Sabbath. Okay, you start the count on the day, that'd be a Sunday, the day after the weekly Sabbath. So, and then it goes on, let's look at some of the other instructions to see another clue here. It says in verse 15, you shall count 7 full weeks from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, you shall count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath. In Hebrew, it's the same word. But what's the day after the seventh Sabbath? What day of the week is it? That would be a Sunday, wouldn't it? So to me, this is very, very clear. Very clear. So it must be talking about from a Sunday unto a to a Sunday. That's clear enough. And you know, the question then would be, well, how do you know that that's the Sunday that falls in the days of unleavened bread? It doesn't say so. Well, from there, you just have to take a shot at it. No. The idea here is that this connects the connection between the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Day of Pentecost. The weeks of harvest, the grain harvest, began during the days of unleavened bread. So you see the connection. You wouldn't want it falling outside the days of unleavened bread. So therefore, you don't begin the count on the morrow after the first Sabbath. You begin the count on the day, on that day after the, well, the first, put it this way, on the Sunday that falls within the days of unleavened bread. You got it? In other words, if the Sabbath falls on the last day of unleavened bread, that would throw the count outside, and then you would lose a little bit of the connection with of the harvest between the feast and the second feast, the second pilgrimage feast. You see what I'm saying here? And so this really connects the harvest festival called Pentecost with the earlier feast. So that's what we go by, and a good many Jewish authorities agree with that. That's what the original actually meant. So, are we all clear on that? Why we don't observe 5 and 6, or at least this group doesn't, and why we don't observe a Monday. Nobody else in history ever did that, up to my knowledge. I don't know how it stuck with us for so long. But in any case, so the day of Pentecost had arrived. No doubt it was a Sunday, the 50th day, the day after the seventh Sabbath, the 7 full weeks of grain harvest. And that's very significant because it's a harvest festival. And the analogy is drawn between the harvesting of crops, the gathering of crops, and the gathering of first fruits of God's spiritual harvest. And in order to have those first fruits to be gathered, guess what you have to have? You have to have conversion taking place. And if you have conversion taking place, you must have what? The Holy Spirit being given. And that's exactly what we see happening here. We'll read down to it. It says, they were all together in one place, meaning the disciples, those 120 we read about last time. And suddenly there came from heaven a sound like a mighty rushing wind, it's like a violent wind. Now I want you to notice three witnesses here. First of all, there's a sound, one you could hear. And evidently it was very loud. We'll see why in just a few minutes. Very loud. It sounded like a very violent wind, like tornadic or maybe hurricane activity going on. Just a very violent wind. And it came from heaven, and it says, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting. So evidently it was located, it was concentrated in this one place here where the disciples were. And divided tongues, or cloven tongues as the KJV says, and other translations have a different way of translating this, as of fire appeared. So there you have, first of all, you have something you, a witness as to what's going on, something you hear, now something you see. You have wind and fire. We'll talk about that in a few moments. It appeared to them, and who says tongues as of fire, or as cloven tongues? Some people confuse this with speaking in tongues, we're going to be talking about here in a moment. It's not talking about tongues of fire, some kind of gibberish. No. These tongues, in other words, these, I guess something like, the idea here is this, is that a fire appears there, a visionary type thing, a fire there in their midst above them, and then from it begins to divide and comes over each one of the disciples, and we'll read what it says here. It says that it appeared to them and rested on each one of them. So the fire that's above begins to divide up, or tongues as it were, goes out from it, and then it rests upon these individuals. So what are we seeing here? What are we seeing? Does it remind us of anything else Anything in the Old Testament? Absolutely. You have all. Yeah, that's right. You have. There's all kinds of things that come to mind there, but we'll come back and examine a couple of them in just a few moments. But it says, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and began to speak in other tongues, meaning languages. These were known languages, not gibberish. They weren't falling around and jumping benches and things like that, as the Spirit gave them utterance. So you have this threefold witness. You have something you can hear, the sound as of a violent wind, something you see, the fire and the tongues coming out and as a witness resting on these individuals, and you have something coming from within, this miracle of languages. So you have this inspired utterance is what it was, inspired utterance. And was actually being done in different real languages. Okay? Now, let's examine some of this before we move on further. You know, in the Old Testament, let's just give you some examples. I'm not going to turn to each one of these, but in Exodus chapter 3, you remember what happens there when Moses sees a bush that appears to be burning, fire. And then he goes to it to investigate, and what does he find? What happens? A voice comes to him. God speaks to him from out of the midst of the fire, apparently through the angel of the Lord. But he speaks to him, and he says, what? Take off your shoes from off your feet. Why? Not because he had anything against sandals or shoes or whatever Moses was wearing. It's because that was the custom of the day. In some lands, it still is. Before you go on into a room, or before you go into a temple or a public meeting place or someone's home, you take the shoes off. That's a sign of respect. So what he's doing is saying, take off your sandals because you're standing on holy ground. Meaning you're in the divine presence. The divine presence is symbolized by fire, the burning bush. So no doubt when the disciples saw this, that must have come to the minds of some of them at some point along the way. This means the divine presence. Another example is in Exodus chapter 13, where I think Ken alluded to this. You had the Israelites going out of Egypt. You had that. I'm not going to turn there and read it. I just summarize it. You can find it in verse 21 in particular. You had them when they left Egypt. God guided them, and how did He do it? He went before them in the cloud by day, so they could follow the cloud, and by night, a pillar of fire. There again, fire. It gave them light. Light pierced the darkness for the people of Israel. God was present. And then let's do turn to these, Exodus chapter 24. Exodus 24. A couple of scriptures here. And again, it's talking about the same thing here. Verse 17 says, this is not talking about the same thing. The one we're going to look at in chapter 40 is talking about the pillar of fire. But in verse 17 of chapter 24, this is referring to the time when Israel had come to Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai. Where did God dwell? According to the text, this was in the mountain. And when they looked up and saw the top of the mountain, what did they see? Well, let's read it in verse 17. It said, now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring or consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. There again, the divine presence is associated with fire. So what does this mean when this fire appeared where the disciples were assembled on the day of Pentecost after they heard this violent wind, the sound of what seemed to be a violent wind? God was present. The presence of God. That's what the Spirit of the Lord is. It's the presence of God. So He was there. He was present. And the wind, the violent wind symbolizing His power. And the light, the fire symbolizing the divine presence, the presence and power of God. We're talking about the Spirit here. So this is perfect symbolism for the Spirit, and I don't think there was a disciple in that room who didn't know what was going on. Who thought, wonder what that is? They knew full well it was the Holy Spirit. The Spirit of God had been poured out. And now they're the recipients of it. And then they began to speak these other languages as further evidence, as if the first two signs were not enough. Not that they did need the other evidence, but nevertheless, the first two signs were great, awesome. I think that would have done it. But now you have this thing coming from within. The Spirit is transforming them in some way, affecting them some way from within, enabling them to speak other languages. So here you have this threefold witness to the divine presence. And another thing I might mention here is when you look at this and you try to get in mind what's going on here, when the fire appears, symbolizing the divine presence, you know immediately your mind goes back to Israel. The fire hovered above them, hovered above the tabernacle. I mentioned Exodus chapter 40. You want to look at that while we're here in the book of Exodus, chapter 40. And just the one verse here, verse 38 says, "For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was on it by night in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys." So when they encamped, what happened? They put the tabernacle, they erected the tabernacle right in the midst of their encampment. And all the children of Israel camped round about it could look at night toward the tabernacle and they could see that glow, meaning the divine presence. God was among them. God was with them. And so that's what you see here when the Spirit, when the fire appears here, apparently above their heads in the room. This symbolizes the presence of God, just as God had been present in ancient Israel. And we know that in ancient Israel that the Spirit rested on particular individuals, the kings, the judges, the prophets, in order to accomplish specific tasks. And now you hear the divided tongues, meaning the Spirit is resting on these individuals because they have a task. And their task involves a new movement of the Spirit about to begin, or was beginning at this point. Now let's continue on. Now there, verse 5, "Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven." Now the reason they were there, of course, is because it was the day of Pentecost, a pilgrimage festival, and they had come there to participate in the festival. "And at this sound..." Now get this, different commentaries have different opinions about this. Some think when they began hearing about the disciples speaking in different languages, that's what it's talking about. I don't think so. I don't think that's what it's talking about at all. "And at this sound," the sound that has been described thus far is the sound of a rushing, violent wind. So it seems that here these disciples were in a house at first, and they heard the sound like a hurricane going on or something. And then all these people round about, all over Jerusalem apparently, they heard it too. And it seemed to be coming from a certain direction. So they went to see what in the world is going on over there. So they were drawn to it. "And at this sound, the multitude came together, and they were bewildered." When they got there, apparently at this point, the disciples had moved out of the house and were apparently in the outer court of the temple, or in that area. They were bewildered because each one was hearing them, the disciples, speak in his own language. "And they were amazed and astonished, saying, 'Are not all of these who are speaking Galileans?'" You know what that means? It means that you do not expect fluent language coming from a Galilean, because they have been known to mangle a few syllables. And apparently they sometimes gagged on the gutturals. You know how some Middle Eastern peoples speak with the guttural sound, apparently they gagged on the guy. They didn't do that so well. And they were, of course, they were people, they looked on them as country people. Hicks, yeah, there you go. Hicks. Galilean Hicks. And here they are speaking fluently in these languages of the peoples who had come there. Now it says Jews, and they were Jews and proselytes, but you know, when the Jews had, many of them had moved out in times past. They were outside of Jerusalem, dwelling in these other lands. We'll read where they came from here in just a few moments. And they, while they were there, of course, they raised families and grew up and had children and all this. And they began to learn the languages of the peoples they were among. There probably some intermarriage going on, and the kids were still retained their Judaism, and yet they were now speaking different languages. It's kind of like you look around the world today. You see Jews all over the world. You see Jews in Asian lands. They look Asian because they've intermarried and they speak Asian languages. Same is true of Jews in Africa, Jews in Europe. That's just the way it is. And this is what you had going on there. So they were speaking different dialects and different languages by this point. And now they hear these Galilean Hicks talking fluently in those languages. And they go on to say, "And how is it that we hear each of us in his own native language?" And here they are: Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes. Proselytes were the people who had been adopted into the Jewish nation. Non-Jews at first, but now they're considered Jews, adopted into the nation. Now you notice here that they moves from east to west. He talks about the people in Mesopotamia, that's east of Jerusalem. Then he moves up to across into, mentions Judea itself here, Cappadocia. You go to the north, you see Asia Minor. Down to the south, you see northern Egypt. And all the way out further to the west, you see Rome. All of these people, by the thousands, had come and gathered into Jerusalem. And they were witnessing this. At the sound of that wind, that rushing mighty wind, that violent wind sound that they went to investigate apparently. And they get there and find these Galileans speaking their languages. What a witness. What a witness. It also says, both Jews and proselytes in verse 11, says Cretans and Arabians. We hear them telling in our own tongues the mighty works of God. Mighty works of God. So that's what they were. They were talking about the things that they had witnessed themselves in the ministry of Jesus and what had happened about the resurrection and these things that were central and to what we call the gospel. Verse 12, and all were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" But others, mocking, said, "They're filled with new wine." Now, somebody once mentioned something to me, made an argument that I thought was kind of interesting, but I think it was just based on a very narrow view of what was actually happening here. He said, "Why would they say that if those people weren't just out there just really, you know, hooting and hollering and carrying on, all that stuff?" The fellow kind of described it like it's something akin to a Pentecostal meeting, old-time Pentecostal meeting. So why would they be accused of being drunk? You know, full of new wine, if something wasn't going on. And my reply to that is that, you see, in the mix of all of this, you have people all excited. They're telling other people what's happening. It's not that everybody there saw them or heard them, but they did hear about them. And what's somebody going to eventually say? "Well, sounds like somebody had a little bit too much to drink to me." Yes. Yeah. You sure that was a language he was speaking? So I suspect that's what's going on here. But then you have something very interesting. Peter stands up. Concerning the wind, I might mention, you know, of course, some scriptures come to mind there as well. You think of the Spirit, right there in Genesis chapter 1, the second verse. The Spirit is hovering over the waters. What does that mean? You know, we know the word Spirit and the word wind, same terms. Or Spirit, the words translated Spirit and breath, you know, breath, wind, this a violent force from God or a gentle breeze. All of that can be translated from the term translated spirit, whether you're talking about the Greek or the Hebrew. You have the spirit in Genesis 1 hovering over the waters, indicating that something is about to happen. Some changes are about to occur, meaning, of course, that the wind is about to blow on those waters. That reminds us of something else, too, doesn't it? Of the Exodus, of how by a blast from his nostrils he parted the Red Sea. You know, what this, of course, is talking about is by the Spirit of God. The divine power, the presence of God is there. God is in heaven, but he can extend himself. He can reach down into this world, and he can perform wonders here, and that's what he does. We see it happening all over the place. And so that's what the disciples, no doubt, with that in their background, that ingrained in their thinking, that's what they immediately recognized as to what was going on, that the Spirit was present. The power of God was present. God himself, in spirit, was present with them and acting powerfully among them. Now, verse 14, but Peter, standing with the 11, this is after the comment, they're all filled with new wine. Peter, standing with the 11, and again, this is apparently in the outer court of the temple at this point. He's got a crowd, quite a crowd around him, lifted up his voice and addressed them, men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give ear to my words. For these people are not drunk, as you suppose, since it is only the third hour of the day. It's 9 in the morning. We wait till noon before we start doing that. Now, obviously, you know, if it's that early, you don't expect to find a lot of drunks staggering around. But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. Now, keep in mind that Peter, what he says here, is not just an opinion. It's not an opinion. Some people look at this and say, well, he was right about what this was, but he was wrong about the date. No. Peter, this was divine utterance here. He was under inspiration of the Spirit that had just made itself known in a powerful way. He says, this is that which was uttered through the prophet Joel. And then he quotes from Joel chapter 2 and verses 28 through 32. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Now, some comments on that. If you want, you don't need to turn there, but I'm going to turn there myself. If you want to, you can, but in Joel. I'm going to go back and look at some, get the context of this prophecy. In context, before these words are said, Peter only quotes a part of them. But it says back in same chapter, verse 26, you shall eat in plenty and be satisfied and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. And my people shall never again be put to shame. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel. So this is a restoration prophecy. It's about the restoration of Israel. And that I am the Lord your God and there is none else. And my people, speaking of Israel here, shall never again be put to shame. So in context, the people of Israel had put up with a lot of shame, a lot of problems, a lot of suffering, a lot of, the results of covenant breaking. But now he promises to restore them. And then he goes on, says, and it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. All flesh meaning what? In that context, well, all kinds of people. All kinds of people. But in context, he is talking about Israel. But as we're going to see as we progress, make our way through the book of Acts, that all flesh comes to mean more than just all kinds of people within Israel. For this movement of the Holy Spirit is going to extend way outside the boundaries of Israel and encompass the world and include peoples from all the nations. So you're going to see this happening in the book of Acts. But if you look at strictly at the context in Joel, it's about the restoration of Israel. And here's the significance of this prophecy. Let's read it as Peter reports it. He says, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. even on my male and my male servants and female servants, in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. Now some people look at this and say, well, where's all the prophesying and the dreams and the visions? Why aren't we seeing all that? They're focusing on the wrong thing. See, those things are just things associated with the presence of the Spirit. But don't focus on those things. Focus on the real significance here, and that is that he's pouring out his flesh no longer on kings and prophets and specially appointed people, but upon even the slaves. Regardless of social class, social status, whoever you are, wherever you are, now it is indeed all flesh. It is sons and daughters, not just the sons, not just particular sons, but sons and daughters, young and old. Now it becomes universal. This indeed is a new move of the Spirit. It is absolutely essential to the church that Jesus built. That's the real significance of this. It's now universal. It becomes universal. No longer just specially appointed people who receive the Spirit, but now regular old people, guys and gals, young and old alike, may receive the Spirit. Just as the prophets did, just as the kings did, just as the judges did, and be moved by it, converted by it, transformed by it, as God gathers his first fruits harvest. Now then, there's something else here. I have a different take on this than some people do. I wanted to mention, though, that this expression, last days, in verse 17, it seems that we have a tendency to, when we read texts that have this expression or similar expressions, like last days, the last time, things like that. Also, the expression in verse 20, latter part of verse 20, day of the Lord. We always attach that to the very time of the end just preceding the second coming of Christ. Make no mistake, the Bible does say very definitely that there will be an end time day of the Lord, that Christ will come in the day of the Lord, that his coming is, of course, a key feature of the final day of the Lord. But there have been many days of the Lord in history. It's very important to understand that, because when you look back and see God acting in history, for example, when he sent the prophet to prophesy concerning Babylon, how Babylon was going to fall, and you look back in history, you see indeed it did. This is called a day of the Lord. That means a day of intervention, a day of visitation. You see what he did in Israel, the day of intervention. That was the day of the Lord. So there are many days of the Lord. Of course, they all point to that last day of the Lord, the one that happens during the time of Christ's return. But here, when you read about last days, day of the Lord, we need to be careful not to just read that exclusively as the very end of the time associated, or the end of the days associated with the second coming of Christ. When I read this verse 17, and in the last days it shall be, last days of what is the question that comes to my mind? Last days of what? See, there are several last days. There are several ways of understanding last days. One is the last days leading up to the second coming. But also, you have to realize that this was the last days of Judaism as it was known in Jerusalem. This was the last days for the temple. You see, the temple was the very heart of Jewish religious practice. It was the heart. Without the heart, there's no life. And when that heart is cut out, as it was in AD 70, then that ended Jewish life the way it had been known and practiced. It didn't end Judaism. There's still Jews with us today. We understand that. But it really cut the heart out of normative Jewish life. So that was the last days of the temple period. That's one way of looking at it. But also there's God's perspective. You know, they say we're told that for God, 1,000 years is like a day, and day like 1,000 years. That's not some kind of secret key to unlocking all the puzzles of prophetic understanding. That's not what that is. What it is saying he's the one who inhabits eternity. The difference between 1,000 days or 1,000 years and a day for him. It's not. What is the difference? If you have inhabited, if you have existed for eternity, if you had no beginning, if you inhabit eternity, then 1,000 years is not much different from a day, is it? That's your perspective. So from God's perspective, the last days begin, the last days, you know, backing up and looking at it historically, from Adam until the second coming. Well, we're in the latter period, aren't we? From his perspective, hey, we don't have much time left. Even if we have another 500, 600 years, who knows? But still, we're in the last days from his perspective. So there's a number of ways of understanding this. Also, again, we'll get to it in a few moments. This expression, day of the Lord, is found in verse 20. As I said, there have been many days of the Lord. And there was a day of the Lord prior to the coming of Christ. All you have to do is look at what the prophet said. Look at Malachi, all these others. What you had was you had the people coming back from the Babylonian captivity, resettling the land, rebuilding the temple. And the ideal was to restore everything as it was supposed to be from the time God instituted the covenant with these people. But what happened was they started building the temple, and then they said, we'll come out and work another day. It's kind of like some building project I start around the house. Still there, years later, still a project that's still... One day. But no, they became lethargic. And again, they started moving away from the ways of God. And the warning from the prophets was, look, you're doing it again. You're doing it again. The same things that got you into the mess to begin with and got you kicked out of the land and into somebody else's land, you're doing it again. And of course, they had trouble after trouble after trouble. They were always dominated by foreign powers. You have the Daniel referring to the succession of Syrian kings, for example. We have historical documentation concerning that and how they treated these people. It was awful, especially under the reign of Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, who offered swine's flesh on the altar of burnt offering and put an idol in the temple and all that, and fully intended to make Jerusalem a Jewish graveyard until he was struck down. It didn't last for him. Then we come to the Roman period. Still, the Romans now. There'd been the Babylonians. There'd been the Greeks, the Persians, and under the Greeks, of course, you had the Persians first. You had the Persians, the Medo-Persian kingdom. Then you had the Greeks, Greco-Macedonian. Had all these Syrian kings from out of the Greek Empire, the empire that Alexander began. And then, if that wasn't enough to dominate and overpower these people, now then the Romans come on the scene. They're more powerful than all the preceding ones combined. The Romans. And I don't know if they're actually more powerful, but they were certainly powerful. And they dominated these people. And that's what you see when you come to the time of Jesus. You see temple authorities in correlating their activities with the Roman authorities. In other words, a lot of this church and state activity going on, especially the state dominating church in this case, and giving them certain privileges as long as they stay in their boundaries. So really, their covenant breaking had gotten them into a lot of trouble. There was a time of visitation preceding this, the coming of Jesus. Now this is what I wanted to bring. The reason I'm saying this is for this reason. It says, and this is why some people say, well, this hasn't been fulfilled. After verse 18, when he says, I will pour out my spirit on the male and female servants, and they shall prophesy, and so forth. Verse 19, and I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood. But notice this, it says, before the day of the Lord comes. Was the coming of Jesus, the coming of the prophesied Messiah, the coming of the Holy Spirit, was that not God's intervention? Was that not a day of the Lord? Of course it was. We think of the day of the Lord as only bad times. No, no, no. The day of the Lord brings bad things to bad people, but it brings good things to the just, to the saints. So it says that these things would precede the day of the Lord, the great and magnificent day. And it shall come to pass that whoever calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. So here you have what you have here. You have all these, when it says it talks about the blood and the fire, the vapor of smoke, what do you think it's talking about? It says the sun will be turned to darkness, the moon to blood. That's not talking about blood moons, by the way. No, what this is apocalyptic language. You see it in the prophets all over the world. Just go back and read the prophets. You see the same language. Language of billowing smoke, the sun being darkened. You know, if you have an invading army moving in and burning down the city, burning up people's homes, burning down buildings and all that, you have all this billowing smoke. And guess what it does to the atmosphere? Kind of gets dark there, doesn't it? Things are not clear. The beautiful skies overhead in the night, they're no longer there for you to go out and enjoy. Your city is destroyed. And this is the kind of language that's being used here to describe that. And guess what? That all did happen before the coming of Jesus and before the coming of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost. So this is not necessarily... Yeah, there'll be those things to happen again and worse. But this, what he says here, fits perfectly what Peter is saying. This is that. This is fulfillment of what Joel said. It fits perfectly. Even with the events as we see them unfolding in history. Now that he goes on to say, well, we'll end this pretty quickly here, and we won't end it, we'll just end it for today. Continue it in the future. But let's go on and see what Peter has to say here a little bit further. He says, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourself know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For David says concerning him..." Now, those of you who were here last time, do you remember what I said about different kinds of prophecy? There are predictive prophecies. There are those types of prophecies that can be described as history written in advance. I gave you some examples. Daniel, for example, he prophesies the succession of kingdoms. That's history written in advance. But there are other kinds of prophecies that are not actually history written in advance, but you see patterns and types and shadows in certain statements in the Old Testament, and they prove prophetic because you see the same types and patterns and so forth being fulfilled in something else. Now, something very important to keep in mind is that when David speaks concerning himself, he has always in the backdrop, in his mind, a larger narrative, which is what? I'm not going to turn there and read it. We've read it before. 2 Samuel chapter 7. The promises God gave to him. In 2 Samuel chapter 7. He says that, "I will set up your kingdom after you." He promises that. But your son, from your own body, meaning not an adopted son. He's talking about Solomon. "From your own body will sit upon your throne that I will establish, and I will establish his kingdom." Doesn't say for a few days. He says forever. Now, you know, somewhere along the way, I'm sure people begin to wonder, why didn't it work out any better than it did? But, you know, the thing is, there was always hope, because they knew that was a promise, and that they knew that God ultimately would fulfill it in this ultimate Davidic king, because God had promised to David, "Hey, your throne is established. It's my throne. I'm the one who established it." So that is it. You read through the Psalms and the struggles of David and what he, and yet his reliance on God, always put that in the context, in the backdrop. Because his faith, his reliance on God had at least that and more, I'm sure. But that is part of it right there. So the things that David says about himself in an ideal way applies to his son's son, ultimately and finally to the ultimate Davidic king, Jesus Christ himself. So here he quotes from David, and he's quoting right out of Psalm 16. We just read what he says here without turning back there. It says, I saw the Lord always before me. Now remember, David is speaking about his own experience involving some crisis that he was in at that time. And also he talks about his confidence that God would deliver him out of it. So I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh also will dwell in hope, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades or Sheol in the from the Hebrew, translated Hades in the Greek. You will not abandon my soul to Hades, the universal grave, or let your Holy One, speaking of himself, see corruption. Now, if that pertained to David, and it's based at least in part on the promise that he gave to David, knowing that David's own son would be his successor and inherit his throne. You know, that's saying, God is saying, I'm with you, David. Yeah, you've messed up a whole lot, but I'm still with you, and I'm going to see to it that your son succeeds you, and your kingdom is not going to be destroyed. So that's in the backdrop. So if this applies to David, verse 27, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption, meaning return to the dust. You have made known to me the paths of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence. And then Peter says, in commenting on this, knowing that it looks beyond David, brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. He's not sitting on the throne, is he? No, he's dead. He's dead. Being therefore a prophet, recognizing that he wrote his Psalms and other things under inspiration, being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set up one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades or the universal grave, nor did his flesh see corruption. So see, Peter applies that. And originally David was talking about his own struggles. But see, it goes beyond David. Because God made an oath to David. Therefore, what he says here establishes a pattern, establishes a truth that applies ultimately to Christ himself. And that's how Peter is able to do this. Some people, you need to be aware of these things for one simple reason. Well, two reasons. One reason is just to, I think it's just awesome to understand these things. But, and I think it's faith enhancing. But the other reason is you will be challenged with things like this. There are people out there, I'm talking about, there's a whole new generation of apologists out there, anti-Christian apologists. Some of them are Jewish and some of them are Muslims. And they will point to things like this and say, this is not about Christ, this is about David. And you have to look at it and say, you know what? They're right. But see, if you're able to see beyond, or see the fact that David is looking beyond himself, and this is based on the oath God made to him, then you can answer. So we need to be able to answer these things because they're out there. People who would challenge our faith. Verse 32, this Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses, being therefore exalted at the right hand of God. And having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured out this that you yourselves are seeing and hearing. For David did not ascend into the heavens. You know, in other words, he's saying, but the son of David, the ultimate Davidic king, he did. Guess where he is? At the right hand of God. And anybody who sits at the right hand of God, ruling on behalf of God, God the Father, is worthy of worship. You don't put angels there. No. For David did not ascend to the heavens, but he himself says, he's quoting from another psalm, Psalm 110, the Lord, if you look at the Hebrew, it's Yahweh. Yahweh said to my Adonai. That's a title of respect. Yahweh said, the Lord said to my Lord. In other words, this is Yahweh talking to the Davidic king. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And then Peter says, let all the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. If you put yourself in the picture, I think you can begin to see why some of them at least were beginning to have some emotions well up at that point. You know, we did. We participated. And of course it did. That's what exactly what happened. Verse 37, now when they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brothers, what shall we do? The next time I'm here, we're going to see the answer to that.